Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Fuel your day with Green Farm's new high protein cooked chicken breast fillets. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
Thanks to Jenny Green for getting us to the end of the week. It's a Friday, September 15th, Al, is it? 17th.
17th, come on, Brie.
This is Game On. Coming up today, Alan Colley and Fergal Brennan are on hand to talk us through the Premier League action. There's boxing in the National Stadium this evening. Chris McNulty sets the scene for us. Plus, we've Jane Mangan on racing and Alison Miller ahead of Ireland's crucial World Cup qualifier against Italy. If you want to get in touch, please text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM. Alan Colley is in studio and it is Friday, Alan.
It is, oh yeah, well sure, we love Fridays,
Marie. We do love Fridays. I just about got there in the end with the old date. I've lost complete track of time.
Yeah, you're just flat at working.
Well, there is that, all right. But yeah, it is Friday and it's going to be a really busy weekend of sport, as it always is. And I feel like I'm saying that every Friday, but it just hasn't calmed down since the start of the summer with Olympics and Euros and GAA and everything. But it's going to settle a little bit now, Al.
I often think about this, Marie. I don't know, are you the same? Because obviously we love sport, but every weekend is like that. Every weekend is so busy, there's so much on. And I often wonder, and I don't want to get myself in trouble here, but I often wonder about people that don't like sport. What do they do?
I don't know. Well, if any of them are listening, text us on 51552 and let us know. Look, it's been an interesting weekend for Manchester United, Alan, for many reasons, I think, because people were expecting them just to keep going on the trajectory that they were on, and that was to keep flying high with Ronaldo. But they came undone against Young Boys, and now there's a lot of questions, not so much about the team, but as usual about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and what he's bringing to the table, and is it enough? And I know you're going to have probably strong views on that, but just given, I suppose, when you think of the players that he's brought in and the team that he has now, okay, look, I know Sancho hasn't hit the heights yet, but when you think of Ronaldo and Varane and he's Fernandes and Cavani and Greenwood and Martial and Rashford and Lingard, you would think that he's probably on the verge of something great, but whether he gets there or not is a whole other question.
But I think if you're saying he's on the verge of something great, it's probably only because of the players that are at his disposal, not because of what he's doing. And it's looking like it's only a matter of time before they win something. I certainly don't get that feeling or that impression with him. As you say, with the players that are there, it's probably more likely because of the quality that they have in the squad. But I certainly don't feel it's anything because of what he's doing. And that's been going on for a while, Marie. Like, and maybe, I don't know if I'm in the minority or the majority or whatever. That's just my own general feeling. And I just don't think he's going to be anywhere near the level of bringing them back to topple a Liverpool. Like, I watched, I know you're a big Liverpool fan, and even watching Liverpool the other night and Klopp and what he demands, it's night and day. It's night and day, Klopp. And even Guardiola and Tuchel at Chelsea, it's night and day what they bring to the table compared to Solskjaer. And it's just a pity Ruby's not here, that I couldn't, because I know he's sticking up for him a little bit. And of course, he has that affiliation that he's a club legend and people are for him. I was down home last week, Emery, and I was in a restaurant having something to eat, right? And a man who we know, well known in the town, comes up to me and he says, "Will you go easy on that Solskjaer fella? You're giving him an awful time." And I says, "That's just my feelings on it, you know." And it really is. And it's more so because of the fact that when they signed Ronaldo, we kind of flagged up a few things that may crop up, and they've already been highlighted during the week. The major thing we cropped up was that if something goes wrong in terms of, does he have to make a change, does he have to leave him out, does he have to take him off, it was blindingly obvious that he had to take him off the other night. They were carrying an extra, once Wan-Bissaka got sent off, you were straight away, not only were you down to 10, you were down to 9 with Ronaldo and the team. And I know for all the stuff he brings, and it's brilliant, and the lift he gave the place, and you look at last Saturday with Newcastle, but that was the one really where Solskjaer, I felt, could have, and so early into the Ronaldo return as well, he could have laid down a marker there to let, because he must be aware of the fact that everybody is having this same conversation in terms of, is he strong enough to manage Ronaldo or the egos? And I'm not saying Ronaldo is troubled by any means, I just mean from the point of view of, he's such a big character and player and influence that he'll feel as though he has to play every match, that sometimes you need a manager to haul him aside and say, look, you won't be playing this one, or I need to take you off here, or whatever, and just be strong enough. And I felt it was a real perfect time for him to do that and to set down the marker and lay it down, let Ronaldo feel, and let everybody else outside to kind of dampen down that noise around Solskjaer. And he didn't do it. And He looked so bad for not doing it, and almost apologetic then to him when he took him off. And then when he did take him off, it was too late in the day because that decision should have been made at half time. Then Young Boys equalised. There only looked like one to be one winner, and then of course they went on and got the winner as well. So I still think, even with Ronaldo, I mentioned it here last week, was it the fact that with him back in the squad and in the team, they are closer to winning it just by having him, but I still think they're a good bit off winning the league.
Fergal Brennan is also with us. Fergal, it was quite interesting to hear Paul Scholes in the pre-match lauding the team but making the point that they still have an unproven manager in Solskjaer, that he still hasn't won them anything at all. And just for an ex-player, somebody that would have been a teammate, to be pointing that out, it's probably quite telling, really, and maybe what the opinion is on that from that group of ex-players.
It is, and I was listening to what Alan was saying there, and this is the difficulty when you're discussing Solskjaer, and particularly with United fans that are very defensive about him or very positive about him. To lay out the facts of what Solskjaer has done at Manchester United is not a crime. He hasn't won a major trophy. He got beat in the Europa League final by Villarreal last season. He's not really torn up any trees or made some huge strides in terms of progress in challenging City or Liverpool for a league title. And for someone like Paul Scholes to come out and say this, I personally don't find it massively surprising. Paul Scholes comes from a school of United where they demanded excellence. They had the best manager in the history of English football. They had the most dominant team in the history of the Premier League. They won title after title. They won two Champions Leagues. He's used to these things. All Solskjaer is doing at the moment is probably hitting par for what Paul Scholes expects from Manchester United. And this is the difficulty, because when you say these things, it sounds like a pile-on to Solskjaer, but it's not. It's just facts. This is the level that Solskjaer is operating at. He's doing a good job. He's doing a solid job. He's making some steps in the right direction. But if United fans want to be back where they want to be, there's very little evidence on the table to say that he is going to do that, or he's even done that so far. And that, you then, as Alan pointed out there with the fella challenging him in the restaurant, you then get pulled off on this for massively criticising him. These are just the facts. These are the facts of the level that Solskjaer is at and the level that he's brought United to so far. He's got this season to change perceptions and change minds, but as it stands, that's the position on Solskjaer.
They have West Ham at the weekend on Sunday, who did win last night against Dinamo Zagreb 2-0. And going into a game like West Ham after losing to Young Boys, it's not a sure thing, because you just don't know how they're going to react.
I don't think it's ever a sure thing with United currently at the moment, even with Ronaldo, Marie. And it makes
how
it
could it not be a sure thing with all those players playing against West Ham? Is it just because of Ole?
Well, West Ham are very good.
Well, they're good.
I think
but
you're being
don't
a bit dismissive of West Ham. West Ham are very good. And Moyes has done a brilliant job since he...
Well, Antonio's missing for one, but they like, if you were to compare the starting 11s, like, there's no comparison.
No, but the games are not won on paper, Marie. That's unfortunately the problem.
But it helps when you have superstars.
Yeah, but sometimes you look at with the players that United have as well, and I don't think it is a foregone conclusion in any match, Marie, because the problem Solskjaer has, and he's going to face it again at the weekend, is, and it was glaringly obvious against Newcastle last week, the midfield area is so exposed. And even the other night he played Van de Beek and Fred, whereas last week he played Matic and Pogba. And until he gets a position where Pogba is actually comfortable in an area where he has the freedom to do what he wants, because he's not disciplined enough to do the stuff defensively, I think they're always going to have problems unless he gets someone alongside him. And the fact that you mentioned West Ham, that they're playing, why they didn't sign Declan Rice, he would have been ideal to play in that position, and then you could afford to have a Pogba beside him because he would do that work. Fred is not good enough to do that with Pogba beside him. Matic's legs are gone. Van de Beek the other night, he got his chance, but again, he was the easy target to take him off at half time and bring Varane on when Wan-Bissaka got injured. I even looked at Leicester last night, and Didi, I know he got sent off late in the day. I don't know why they haven't gone, because Marie, for all the attacking talent that they have, the main omission in the team and the main area where they were struggling was that centre midfield area. And until they get someone to do that job, they'll always struggle, and they won't topple a Chelsea, and they won't topple a Liverpool, and they won't topple a Man City, because they have the players basically in all those positions. And when Klopp, as you well know, the positions that he needed in terms of a centre half and the positions that he needed to address a goalkeeper, bang, he goes and gets them. Solskjaer has created problems for himself, because how he's going to get all that attacking into the team. The other night he played Pogba, who people were saying, oh, Pogba's doing great, 7 assists. Pogba played left of a three the other night, anonymous in the game. Like, it's a waste of time. And they're just trying to fit these fellas in. It's like round holes and square pegs, and it's just, honestly, are square pegs and round holes, is it? I'm getting confused with it now, Marie. But that's the major problem, as yeah. And to answer your question, I'm gone about it in a long-winded answer there. West Ham will be a difficult game, because West Ham are very good.
They will, but you have just complained there about having too many good players, which isn't a bad place to be in.
If you're a top quality manager, you'd be able to deal with all that, because he accommodates them and he indulges them, and you can't do that. You have to make tough, hard decisions, and that's why Guardiola is so good, because he's able to cater for all the players that he has. Klopp the same. Klopp left Henderson out of the team the other night and played young Harvey Elliott. I know he got injured, but that's what you do. You make the tough decisions, you make the hard decisions, and that's why they're so good, and Solskjaer hasn't won anything.
Fergal, let's move on to Spurs and Chelsea, the really big game of the weekend, and probably not an ideal opponent for Spurs after losing such a, I suppose it was a surprise really to lose 3-0 to Crystal Palace. And if you throw a second defeat on it, as Alan said, it's not a foregone conclusion. But if Chelsea do go out and beat Spurs, when those losses do start to multiply, it does put a huge amount of pressure on Nuno.
It does, and I still think we haven't really got an actual picture of what Nuno is all about at Spurs. The first couple of weeks were dominated by Harry Kane. What's going to happen with Kane? Is he staying? Is he going? And that kind of moved the conversation, so there wasn't really a great amount of focus. And he did have quite a solid start. I think it was 3-1-0 wins back-to-back, which obviously meant that there was no pressure on him in terms of a poor set of results, and then obviously the Harry Kane story hanging over him in the background. Looking at this, it will be difficult for Spurs. This is always earmarked as a pretty good Premier League game. Chelsea against Tottenham, they're normally crackers. There's normally a big load of red cards and a few goals. But Chelsea, for me, have probably been the most impressive team this season. I know United are edging them out just about on I think it's goal difference or goals scored so far. But Chelsea haven't missed a step. It's only that 45 minutes that they played with 10 men away at Liverpool, where we've seen them maybe be asked a few questions. They look so slick, so organised, right the way through the team, in every department. They look so strong. They've got a really good bench where they can rotate and alternate depending on who they're up against. And I have been relatively impressed with Tottenham so far this season, but it is very difficult to gauge what Nuno's plan is. We saw at Wolves, when the going was good, what a good coach he is and how he's able to kind of spin miracles out of good players, not world-class players, but good players. Now he's dealing with a team with much higher objectives. They're looking to get into the top four conversation this season, and we're still yet to really see exactly what he's about. The signs have looked good without being great, but for me, Chelsea have been absolutely excellent, and I really fancy them to win again and keep the pressure up on Liverpool and United in the first few weeks.
What's becoming a problem for Nuno, Alan, is that he's starting to be compared to Mourinho, and with Mourinho's recent history in the Premier League, that's not a good thing. recent history,
exactly. Yeah, I'm kind of with Fergal on it. I don't think we've had a kind of full look at Spurs yet, in terms of they obviously got off to a good start before the international window, and then they suffered a heavy defeat last week. But I think it's going to take maybe 10-12 games before we actually start to see a pattern in terms of just what he's all about with this Spurs team. Because you think back at that Wolves team, he was very much counter-attack, but I felt he did a very good job at Wolves, and he was probably ready for the move. Whether he's the man, I suppose this is the question, but who is the man to bring Spurs back into maybe top four and eventually try and win things? Because, as you say, look at Pochettino, Mourinho, they've had great managers in recent times, and none of them has delivered on that. So he's a tough job ahead of him. I think the biggest thing for him at the moment is obviously trying to get Harry Kane back involved, in terms of last week, I don't think he had a shot on target or he even touched the ball in the box against Crystal Palace. I know they got well beaten and they were down to 10 men, but you have to basically try and build your team around him now that he's staying and he's keeping him. But I think it's a tough game for them against Chelsea at the weekend, and I would agree with Fergal on Chelsea as well, although you have to flag up last week against Aston Villa played really, really well, and only for the goalkeeper. I know Lukaku is getting all the rave reviews at the moment, and he is the difference, but the goalkeeper played really well for them last week as well.
Fergal, a lot of talk this today actually about Virgil van Dijk, because Jurgen Klopp was speaking to the media and he said that he's looking at the long-term picture really rather than the short-term picture in when he deals with him and decides when to play him. But I think looking at them in Champions League action during the week, it just shows how vital he is. And if he is going to be picking and choosing what games he's going to be playing him, the big ones are the important ones, because he is a player they can't seem to do without.
Yeah, and I think it comes down to the player that he is and the other attributes that he brings, the leadership, the organisation, particularly with a defence like Liverpool where the fullbacks play so high up in Trent on one side and Andy Robertson on the other. But this will be a conversation that Klopp will have had with the Liverpool medical team. They will have essentially got the calendar out and thought, right, based on his rehab, based on the fact that he's been out for 9-10 months with a very, very serious injury, where can we afford him a break? Where can we balance and make sure that the injury is being given time to heal, the swelling to go down, the recovery to make sure there's not being that no step is essentially being missed? And I looked at the team the other night against Milan, and yes, when he's fit, it is always a surprise to not see Virgil van Dijk's name on the team sheet. But Liverpool are in a position, I said this in midweek when we were previewing the game, Liverpool, for me, are in a position that they should be able to beat AC Milan without Virgil van Dijk. And based on the first 40, 45-ish minutes, they should have been 2-3, 4-0 in front. So they can manage without him. They can beat kind of middle to maybe European qualification level teams without him. I don't think Klopp necessarily made a mistake by leaving him out. It will probably be in conjunction, as I said, with the medical team making a judgment of where can we fit in a break, where can we look to give him a little bit of rest to make sure that he's not being overloaded. He'll go straight back into the team against Palace this weekend. But you're right, he is absolutely huge. Looking ahead to some of the fixtures in the next few weeks and months, I don't think Klopp will hesitate to rest him again, just because maybe there was a little bit of a creak in the road against Milan. They have Norwich in the Cup in midweek, Brentford next weekend. I wouldn't be surprised to see him maybe rotated in and out, particularly now they've got Joe Gomez back and Ibrahima Konate, who they paid all that money for this summer, that's yet to really kick a ball. Liverpool fans obviously want to see Van Dijk on the pitch and playing and bossing games for them, but they do have to balance what is a very, very difficult recovery from a really serious injury.
Yeah, for sure. And I think now more than ever, and especially after last season, it just shows how important it is, and keeping him fit probably long term is the best thing that they can do with him. And almost like a Rolls Royce, you know, whenever they need him at his best,
bring him out for a Sunday drive. Exactly. Is that what you're saying? The likes of that.
He does look like he's just cruising around when he is on the pitch. Arsenal, Al, do you think we're seeing the start of the Arsenal revival now? They did get a win last week against Norwich, but they haven't proved anything at all. And it's just hard to see like where they are. So they're playing Burnley. They're now 16th on the table. Just one win.
Yeah, they've had such a dreadful start, but it was a tough start, the games that they had. And obviously last week was huge in terms of the fact we're playing Norwich, who have, I think, lost all their games so far. So it was so important that they beat Norwich. And they made heavy weather of it, but they got the win in the end, which was the most important thing. Of all the fixtures that they could have, bar playing the top teams, Burnley is probably the one that didn't want Murray this weekend, because Burnley will do all the things to them that Arsenal hate, because they're so physical, they're so strong, not an easy place to go, Turf Moor. Sean Dyche just signed a new contract during the week as well. He does a brilliant job with Burnley, and for all the faults that Arsenal have, and in terms of how sensitive we kind of say they are and how weak they are in the soft underbelly, Burnley will exploit every one of those things at the weekend. So the fact that you says they got the win, is the revival begun? I don't think they'll get a result tomorrow. I think Burnley might beat them.
Fergal?
It's a tough one, yeah. I see where Alan's coming from, because the win last week was scrappy win, incredibly scrappy goal to get it. I still think there's massive issues and massive questions for Arteta to answer. I'd maybe give Arsenal a bit of slack and go for a draw, but Burnley are right down there themselves. They've only got 1 point so far this season, and Dyche knows he himself needs to start turning the wheel. So yeah, I'd give Arsenal a bit of slack, as I say, and hopefully they can dig in and get a point, because Burnley will make it hard. But in attack, Burnley are really, really short of quality, so I'd go for a draw.
Alan, usually Pep Guardiola is pretty untouchable. He doesn't get too many things wrong, except for big games in the Champions League when he's setting up his team. But in general, he doesn't get too much wrong. But he seems to have got this issue with the fans wrong. So he called for more fans to turn the Man City games. And they're not happy about it, because obviously the price of tickets and everything is huge. What do you think? Do you think he should have just said nothing, or could you get where he was coming from?
So I'm on his side. because I listened to it today and the comments that he made, that fan that came out, I think Mr. Parker, that came out against him and had a go at him, he basically had a go at him for something Guardiola never said. He basically was saying that Guardiola came out and said during the week that he was disappointed the fans didn't come up. All Guardiola said was that he wants more to come out to the games. And he stood up for himself in the press conference today. I listened to his comments. And I think he's fine to say that, Marie. But in terms of, I suppose, you're looking at the likes of Liverpool's fan base, Man United's fan base, Man City are a good bit off that. And they always will be. And I'm not sure how you'll ever replicate that type of fan base. I know if you keep winning, maybe. But I just don't think you can make yuppie fans. I think you're either the fans or that are there throughout their history and their heritage that have been there for such a long time, as we see with those clubs, as I mentioned, whereas Man City have only become successful in recent times since the money has come into the club. And unless you see kids now with a newer generation of fans coming up,
yeah,
because
which
to see
you do
them,
though, like you'd,
yeah,
you'd
because
see
to see them being
football,
successful,
yeah.
But I still think Man United, Liverpool, even young kids coming up, still want to support those teams because they're being influenced maybe by their parents or grandparents or whoever. Whereas I still don't see Man City, I don't see too many young fellas wanting to support Man City, despite the fact that they're very good now and they win a lot. So yeah, I would be with Guardiola. I think your man Mr. Parker got jumped the gun a little bit, but yeah, I think Guardiola just probably made the comment after the match. I don't think he meant anything by it. I'm sure when you go in, because I went over to a game in the Etihad, Marie, I remember talking about it here on the show a couple of years back against Chelsea, and it was like a library, and it was this makey-uppy stadium that it was, if it was just built somewhere else and they moved it from wherever they built it and just plopped it into this university campus on the Etihad outside of Manchester. And it was so soulless and so lifeless, and I came away thinking there was no reference to any history or any heritage or any, you know, you go into grounds and you see statues of former players and memorabilia and all that. There was nothing like that. And I remember coming away from that thinking, like, this is just money, pure money. That's all it is. That's the only reason it's there. And in terms of a fan base, you're not going to create new fans, I don't think, where they are.
Well, that Mr. Parker is Kevin Parker, and he is the General Secretary of City's official supporters club, and he found Pep's comments to be frustrating. He said they're not factual. Their attendance are generally excellent. He said that Guardiola doesn't understand the difficulties that some people might have getting to a game on a Wednesday evening at 8 p.m. So it was after there was 38,000 at that Red Bull Leipzig game, and the stadium holds 55. I guess, Fergal, one thing that could probably increase their fan base would be to add a Haaland or a Harry Kane to it as well, because like, when you think about growing football clubs, as Alan says there, like, a lot of it is just getting those kids who are 5 and 6 coming out, just starting to watch the Premier League. But before COVID, when I went to any Liverpool games, a lot of them were fans from overseas as well. It was the global market. Now, obviously, they can't travel now, so that might affect it a little bit. But these teams are not just now confined to England. Fan bases are not confined to England, and clubs are looking at it on a global scale as well.
Yeah, and that's essentially the point moving forward in terms of the next generation of supporters. And I agree and I disagree with what Alan was saying about how Manchester City are maybe not making the impact on younger fans that United or Liverpool, etc., could have done, because what I think we're seeing more and more of now is younger fans that are fans of players, and they'll follow individual players to certain clubs, Messi, Neymar, Ronaldo, etc. And as you rightly say, clubs that are not necessarily based in the Premier League, fans will go and support a team in France. They'll go and support PSG, young fans supporting PSG, Barcelona, Real Madrid, because they have access to watch them on TV. They can watch clips on the internet. They can follow these players. They can play it on FIFA. And they get more and more involved in these types of things. And Man City will be looking at that with a Haaland and with an Mbappe, because they know that by hook or by crook, however they want to do it, fans, particularly younger fans, will follow these young players, these iconic players that they do have a connection with. And Haaland and Mbappe are absolutely representative of a new generation of players and a new generation of fans. And City can talk about filling stadiums or packing out home games on a midweek night, but in reality, the move that football is making now, every massive signing you make, you immediately accrue more fans, be they match-going fans at the stadium, be they online, be they online subscriptions, television subscriptions, however you want to measure it, you immediately get that. Ronaldo's moved to United. United flagged up a ridiculous surge in social media interactions and sales of club merchandise and all these types of things. And as much as some of that might be kind of a bit of a dirty word and people don't want to use that in measurement of real fans, that's how the club measure these things. That's how they measure their fans and their fan bases. And when you bring in an enormous name like that, you immediately bring with them fans. So I do fully expect City to go absolutely hell for leather this summer to sign. Probably, I think Haaland is more likely than Mbappe. I think Mbappe to Madrid looks almost nailed on. I personally think the Harry Kane door might be closed now. I think all attention will be on Haaland. His release clause is going to be dropped. And you know with Haaland, the brand that he brings with him is exactly what City want to buy into.
Yeah, well, I completely agree with you. As someone who has a son who supports PSG, a seven-year-old son, I had to go on to the PSG website last night and I promised him something with Mbappe on it if he did well in his spelling test.
But isn't that everything that's wrong? Well, not for your kid, Marie, but I mean, is that everything that's wrong with modern-day football? If clubs are signing players because they're a brand, not for the footballing reasons. Now, obviously, Haaland's going to be a superstar, so that is football as well. But
there's so few of them players, though, Al. When you think about it, there's only about five or six of that at that level.
Yeah, but I still don't think
bigger than the clubs.
I still don't think if you sign a Haaland that they're going to get 45,000-50,000 every week, or what Guardiola was complaining about during the week. They might in terms of jerseys and subscriptions and the stuff Fergal's talking about, but you won't create.
But we're going to Paris in October to go to see.
Yeah, but that's like a one-off
PSG.
Trip.
Yeah, but that's what people do. They go.
Yeah,
on one-off
but that's
trips.
Like a one-off trip.
And there's millions of people in the world. Alan.
No, I know that.
But
Guardiola is talking about. I'm talking about fans who are going week in, week out. That you're a real hardcore, diehard fan. That you're there, like what Man United have, like what Liverpool have, every week. The big clubs. That's what Guardiola is saying. Whereas the other night at the Leipzig Champions League match, and there's only 38,000 at it. 38,000 is a lot. But he wants 55 or whatever he wants.
And that's fair enough. Okay, we better take a break. We have been going on way too long here. Fergal Brennan, thank you so much. Alan Colley, stay with us.
Game on 2FM with Green Fern. Have your dinner ready in a flash with Green Fern's high protein cooked chicken breast fillet. Available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Now we are turning our attention to boxing because boxing is back. I'm delighted to say that journalist Chris McNulty is with us. Chris, for the first time in 2 years, the elites are going to be held in the National Stadium. It must be a huge, I suppose, look, sense of occasion and a reason to celebrate for everybody involved in boxing.
Yeah, and I suppose, Marie, a sense of relief as well, like because the last version, the 2020 version, was actually held, but was held because of major championships coming up, was held in November 2019. Like, it's almost 2 years since we've had an elite championship. And, you know, for sports people at any level, that's a huge, huge break. Like, for, you know, what's the biggest day in their national sporting calendar. So it's a sense of relief as much as, obviously, the sense of celebration and the sense of excitement, anticipation, and everything that always comes with the elite championships.
So what can we look forward to? Who can we see? Because obviously at the Olympics we were just looking at that Irish team and we were getting so invested in everything that they do. So we're looking to see them in action again. Are many of them going to be there?
Well, I suppose, yeah. You know, I suppose the most obvious thing is, and it's no surprise, you know, it may be disappointing for, you know, the observers and stuff, but it's no surprise that the likes of Kelly Harrington, Aidan Walsh and Emmett Brennan have decided to take an extended break. Aidan's obviously recovering from the ankle injury he unfortunately sustained in Tokyo. Kelly probably has her mind and her eyes now. She's you know, committed to staying at amateur. The 2021 Women's World Championships will take place later in the year, and Kelly, again, taking a break after all that she's been through this year and coming off that gold medal, coming off that high, taking a well-deserved break. But we do have we do have Olympians, and first up is Kurt Walker. He fights in what's a loaded featherweight division, actually, in this Irish Elite Championships. Probably the most exciting of the weight divisions in terms of who's in it. It kicks off tonight, actually, with Jude Gallagher, who was the 2020 flyweight champion. He's gone up a weight. He fights Patrick Adams, a previous champion as well, and it'll be an all-action bout tonight then. Kurt has an interesting bout tomorrow night. Kurt was, of course, unfortunate to lose to Jude Reagan in the Olympic quarterfinal a few weeks ago. He fights Adam Hessian, who earlier this summer was a European under-22 silver medalist, and Adam, one of the rising stars of Irish boxing, so that's certainly a division to keep an eye out for. Michaela Walsh goes in a semi-final next week at 57 kilograms. Brendan Irvine, another Olympian, already in the 54 kgs final. And Aoife O'Rourke has entered, but unfortunately for Aoife and Irish boxing fans, no other opponents. She's the walkover winner. couple of other things, Marie, very interestingly, Darren O'Neill returns to action. I didn't realise until this morning, it's actually almost 4 years since Darren O'Neill had a competitive boxing fight. He's going down in weight and fights this weekend, actually, in a something of a historic bout, Ireland's first ever Irish elite cruiserweight bout. Darren's come down from winning three heavyweight titles in recent years. He fights Cian Tucker, and I suppose this is two boxers at the opposite ends of the spectrum. Darren celebrated his 36th birthday on Monday, and Cian's again one of the rising, another one of those rising stars. He missed the European under-22s because of an illness earlier this year, but he's very, very highly rated by the Irish coaches and by those in the high-performance unit. And look, Darren O'Neill needs no introduction, a seven-time champion, and really over the last decade and a bit has been probably one of the great Irish amateur boxing servants, and it'll be interesting to see how Darren gets on. I would suggest a weight that he's more capable of. So look, while a few of our stars aren't taking part, Marie, there's certainly no shortage of interesting bouts and interesting fights over the next couple of weeks.
So what would Darren's motivation be at this stage to be coming back again and putting himself through all this? Is it just the love of it?
It has to be, but I suppose it just has to be the want of more as well. I mean, go back 2 years ago, Darren had actually flicked over to the pro ranks, and for one reason or another, never got to actually make that change over. So I suppose maybe is there a sense of maybe not so much unfinished business at this particular level, but feels that he has more to give, feels he has more to get. And, you know, Darren has, you know, obviously carried himself with great pride and, you know, carried himself with great distinction, and obviously feels that there's something more for him to give and something more for him to get over the next couple of weeks. And, you know, I suppose looking at it, seven Irish titles and all else that he's done and won, it may have been easy for him to hang up the gloves, but that's those of us looking from the outside, and those people at that level, like when they have that bit between their teeth, as obviously Darren has as well, a great warrior and a great competitor. He just sort of wants to go again, and here he is this weekend. And again, I suppose the cruiserweight, the introduction of the new, there's a few sort of changes in terms of weight classes, or in terms of weights, not weight categories as such. He probably feels that this suits him more than the heavyweight division. He was maybe a bit small, maybe a bit outmatched at times at heavyweight, so probably feels that the cruiserweight division will suit him better.
And just in with the pandemic, and you think about the effect that it has had on sport over the last 18 months or so, how has boxing been affected just in terms of the depth of athletes there?
Well, I suppose not just in terms of the pandemic, Marie, but just, I mean, it's something I spoke about in the show a couple of months ago, was the talent that has been lost to Irish amateur boxing. And, you know, if you're asking, like, who to look out for this weekend, look at the amount of young boxers that have been lost to the pro ranks. I mean, last weekend alone, I was over in the Sky Dome in Coventry. The McKenna brothers from Monaghan and Brett McGinty all fighting on a Hennessy Sports Promotions card. They're 24, 22 and 23 age-wise, respectively. I mean, they would be really adding energy and adding fireworks to these championships where they're in it. I mentioned Jude Gallagher at fighting in a featherweight preliminary bout tonight against Patrick Adamus. Jude in his 2020 flyweight bout beat Regan Buckley, who in his early 20s retired from boxing in the early months of 2020 just because he basically couldn't afford to give anymore. And that's an unfortunate, I suppose, consequence of where the sport has gone, that, you know, many young boxers. And there are a lot more examples of those who have turned over to pro and those who just feel that they didn't have any more to give. But on the flip side of that, there's a great, you know, Ireland had a great under-22s. Unfortunately, Dean Clancy, who was a medalist also in Italy in the European under-23s, isn't in action at these championships due to a sickness. But he's another one of those, like I mentioned the two guys there, Cian Tucker and Adam Hesse, and there's a strong cohort of young boxers, and not to mention the likes of Michaela Walsh and Brenton Irvine, who we will see in action over the next couple of weeks, as well as Kurt Walker and the obvious, you know, our Olympic medalist Kelly and Aidan. There is still a very, very strong cohort of young and able and willing boxers out there to keep an eye on.
And what about from a female point of view? We talk so much about pathways and can't see, can't be, and the knock-on effect of seeing female athletes have success. But is it translating to numbers and interest?
Well, it is, because, you know, if we look at participation, if we look at success of young Irish boxers coming through, I mean, I mentioned the likes of Michaela Walsh there. We look at Amy Broadhurst, who's in there. We look at Aoife O'Rourke, who's come in there. you know, it has translated. I suppose the unfortunate thing, if we go up to the elite level and look at the situation of Aoife O'Rourke, there's maybe not enough of them at that elite level, but it certainly has in terms of participation. I mean, you go through the country now, a lot of coaches and a lot of clubs will tell you about the kids coming through the door and the high percentage, the high volume of female boxers that are coming through. I see it up here in Donegal myself over the last, you know, probably over the last 10, 12 years, the explosion of boxing. I mean, before that, it was unheard of. It just didn't happen for female boxers. And even in this part of the country, that participation level, never mind the success, but it certainly has translated. And look, Kelly Harrington staying at amateur level should really, really assist that. It's a great, I would suggest, coup, if that's the right word to say, for the IABA and for Irish amateur boxing to have retained the services of Kelly Harrington. You know, much and all, I suppose there were, you know, the eyes were fluttered maybe from certain quarters at professional, but it's great to see. And it's a great, I suppose I mentioned those young boxers who are turning over, but it's a great endorsement of what's still there at amateur level to see Kelly Harrington in the weeks after her Olympic gold medal and staying at amateur and staying at this level to compete, I suppose, for another cycle.
Okay, well, Chris, thanks for talking us through all that. Plenty to look forward to, and we'll check in with you again very, very soon. We're going to take a very quick break now, and then we're back with rugby. Nope, my ads aren't working, Alan. Nope. So you're going to have to talk to me now. So let's now move on to...
I organised that.
You actually did. Do you know what happened there now? I hadn't spoken to you in ages and you were so quiet and you were building up there now. Let me get in here. I'm not sure about this boxing, but now I want to have my moment, and it is your moment, Al, because I do want to talk about the Extra.ie FAI Cup quarterfinals, which are taking place tonight. Some really interesting ties. Look, we have Bowes and Maynooth University Town, and Maynooth University Town are getting a huge amount of coverage because they are the unexpected team to get in there. But coming up against Bowes, do they have much of a chance?
I don't think so, Marie, and you don't want to be disrespectful to any team, but they shouldn't have a chance really when you think where they're coming from. But to have Barry Prenderville looking after them, Kieran Kilduff, who everybody knows would have had a good career in the league as well, and they've big plans, I think, to progress forward in terms of where they want to go. But certainly this game tonight against Bohemians are the favourites, I think, to win the cup now, and I don't think they have any chance now.
What about Dundalk? They have to go to Finn Park, a huge test. They're in a situation that nobody expected them to be in, and I guess probably at the end of last season with all of the upheaval and the start of this season, but you know, we thought that it was going to be difficult for them, but to be at the very bottom of the table, or I mean, close to the relegation spots, how important is it going to be for Vinnie Perth and Dundalk to actually try and get some sort of silverware to salvage their season?
Yeah, well, obviously, you, that's what you set out for at the start of the year, but when you look at where the Armoury, does anybody give them any hope of winning any silverware? And I know they have a good group of players still in terms of the squad, but none of those players seem to be playing at the moment for them, for whatever reason. You look at all the issues off the pitch, and it's unacceptable, really. Whoever's to blame, I know there's probably a load of factors involved. Obviously, we're not at the coalface in terms of what isn't going on at Dundalk. But when you think of where they were to where they are now, and it's absolutely, and I know we've seen history of this with clubs in the League of Ireland over the years, and to do the best, to do their absolute best to kind of ruin things when they're at top, on top, Marie. But this was, for me, this is the biggest disaster we've seen in League of Ireland terms when you think of where they were, the money that they earned, obviously investors coming in, all sorts, the success that they had with Stephen Kenny. And when you think of where they are at the basically second from bottom now in the table with the highest budget that we've ever seen in the League of Ireland, it's completely unacceptable. It's an absolute shambles, really. And as I say, I don't think one person is to blame, or I don't think a few people are to blame. I'm sure there's a load of factors involved here, Marie, stemming back, as you say, back to last season, the issues they had also. But I just think it's quite sad because we need as many good teams as we can to progress the league. Dundalk, we've always been one of those teams in recent years, and they were the ones setting the standard, and when you think of how far they have dropped, it's incredible, really.
Yeah, it's pretty frightening stuff.
They're playing Finn Harps tonight in the quarter final of the cup. I would give Finn Harps an unbelievable chance, Marie, going into that game tonight, because they're coming off the back of a brilliant run themselves. I know they got beat the other night, and that good run came undone. But I think they had were unbeaten in seven and had won six before that. So they're in a really good run of form themselves, Finn Harps. And obviously they're at home tonight in Ballybuffet in front of their own fans. I give them a brilliant chance against Dundalk.
Okay, and the other two games, we have St Pat's and Wexford and then Waterford and UCD.
Yeah, so St Pat's again going up against Wexford. Wexford obviously languishing down the bottom of the first division. St Pat's riding high. You would fancy St Pat's as well, and they should get the job done. I know they got beat last week in the league by Sligo Rovers, but I definitely think they'll get back on track and get themselves into the semi-final. And to be fair to Stephen O'Donnell, if you were to ask the Pat's fans at the start of the year, second in the league, be in a semi-final of a cup, they would have snapped your hands off for that. He's doing a really good job, Stephen, and I think they will get into the semi-final. And the other one, I'm heading over to Belfield myself, UCD and Waterford. This is the trickiest one to call, Marie, to be fair, even though Waterford have improved, but Andy Myler's doing a good job at UCD as well, and they have the young lad under 21 international up front, Colin Whelan, scoring goals for them every week, so he's very dangerous. I think it's really hard to call, but I'm just going to edge towards the experience that maybe Waterford and the Premier Division team have. But it is tough to call.
There has to be a shock somewhere else.
Finn Harps. But that's not even a shock for me at the moment.
Okay, let's take a very quick break, and then Alison Miller is going to join us to preview Ireland and Italy.
Game on 2FM with Green Firm. Get back on track after summer with Green Firm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillet range. Available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Now we are going to turn our attention to rugby. The Ireland women have a must-win World Cup qualifier against Italy on Sunday, and to talk us through how it potentially will play out, I'm delighted to be joined by former Ireland international Alison Miller. Ali, look, it's an interesting one, and probably a conversation that has taken a totally different tone now after their shock defeat to Spain earlier in this week. And we're in a stage now where they just need to turn things around, really. And do you think that they can do it on time to go out and get the win against Italy?
Yeah, obviously a shock defeat to Spain. It all depends how they mentally bounce back from the defeat to Spain. They would have went into this tournament as the favourites, kind of from their performance in the Six Nations. They obviously bet Italy in that Six Nations game well enough. Obviously there was a lot of errors in that game, but Italy put in a really good performance against Scotland. So it's going to be a tight game. Ireland obviously can win the game. It's just how they bounce back and fix all those errors that they showed the other night.
There was a lot of criticism in the aftermath about the errors, as you mentioned there, about their set pieces, just about their whole game plan, really. It's a lot, really, Ali, when you think about it, when you just think of their performance, and if you looked at how Italy played in their opening game as well, to try and get up to not only that tempo, but also to be at the level from a skills point of view as well. It's a huge amount of improvement. Now, we did hear Stacey Flood come out yesterday, and she said that they had the review and they looked at the issues, but they're confident that they can put things right. If you were to look at some of the specifics that they need to do, what are they?
Obviously, the line-out malfunctioned a lot during the game, so that needs to be tidied up. Scrum was under pressure as well, and I'm speaking about those two areas as being a former winger, so I'm not going to say a whole lot, but they did malfunction. So, like, if you don't have set-piece, you know, if it's not good enough, you're not going to be able to launch anything from those. Obviously, there was we need to improve our breakdown accuracy. We got turned over quite a lot. We were trying to go wide. We got good change. I was going wide early with the Parsons try, but then like Spain kind of figured that out, and a lot of those players would be sevens players, so they're used to defending the wide pitch quite well. So they probably need to vary their game plan a bit better in terms of what the other team are presenting to them. They were doing a lot of stuff behind the game line as well, so that needs to really be improved. Like, Italy are a very good side. They have a lot of experience. Solari and Rigoni in the centres have been playing together for quite a long time. Barton, the 9, Furlan, the 14, while she previously played a 15. Manuzzi is very dangerous. And as you said, Italy have showed a lot of lovely skills, beautiful hands, offloading ability. Their fitness has really improved over the last while. So in Donnybrook, during the Six Nations, Italy didn't kick at all. They didn't even try to exit. So in the game against Scotland, they actually did try to exit. They exited well. They were varying their game up with some kicking. So Ireland's defence needs to be really on point. We saw for the Spanish try, Eimear Constant kind of coming up, rushing out of the line, and they need to be able to just, you know, stick to their systems, what their systems are. And the Italian pack are big. They're a big pack. They have a really good maul, and they need to be able to stop. And also, I suppose the weekend was Monday. Ireland's line speed wasn't where it should have been, so they need to, you know, fix all these things. Get their speedsters involved. We'd like to see Bavin Parsons and Amy Lee Murphy Crowe, if they're not getting the ball, to come in off their wings and get involved and get those girls on the ball, because, you know, we saw how damaging, obviously, Amy Lee Murphy Crowe try was disallowed because of the knock on, but it was quite a good try regardless of the fact that Catherine Dane had a knock on.
And just in terms of the game management then as well, so like clearly Ireland were struggling in certain areas against Spain. Italy is going to be a tougher test, just given what they were capable of doing in their opening game. What does Adam Griggs need to do though if they find themselves in a similar situation when things aren't going right?
Well, first of all, I think before they even start the game, I hope selection, there might be a few changes in selection. Claire Molloy wasn't even on the bench, a world-class player who would have showed, like, I suppose on Monday there was a lack of leadership among the team. There was no one that really, you know, got everyone in and tried to sort out the issues. So I hope to see her involved in that back row. She's a girl that will slow down ball and really irritate the Italians. So before even that, there might be some different selections. I hope there is. I hope, obviously, she's in and maybe another player or two. But, they need to be able to control the tempo of the game and really, you know, use their strengths. Like, the line-out, you know, at times of the weekend, they didn't try and just, you know, bring up the two ball. Like, they were really struggling. They kept, you know, losing their ball. So just small things like that, kicking like at the weekend, or I keep saying the weekend, it was Monday, but on Monday, you know, use their kick game more efficiently. There was probably space in the backfield against the Spanish, and we didn't use that at all, or to try and gain territory. So we'll need our senior players to step up as well. The more experienced heads, the more capped players like Sene Nayupu, Kira Griffin, Lindsay Pete, those players get involved. On Monday, we didn't see a huge lot of physical carrying from our forwards, such as Dorothy Wall, Lindsay P, Kira Griffin. We need those players on the ball to get game line, so we can play wide and actually earn the right to go wide. We were probably trying to go wide too often, too early, when we hadn't actually gained the right to do that. So there's going to be leadership is going to be really important. Not panicking. Taking that erratic nature out of the play that we saw on Monday to really calm things down. And, you know, obviously, slow down when we need to and speed it up. But there has to be, you know, I suppose a mental toughness to this team as well, that they can go out there and actually not be afraid to perform, because we didn't see that on Monday.
Okay, a very quick prediction, Ali.
Ireland. It's going to be a tight game, but Ireland to sneak it.
Okay, thank you so much for joining us, Alison. And that game will be on the RTE Player as well, if anybody is looking for it on Sunday. Now, Jane Mangan joins us to look ahead to all of the weekend's racing. But Jane, let's first of all start with Davy Russell. We had him on the show earlier in the week. He was delighted to be back. So he did get back to action today in Downpatrick. How did he get on?
The two rides that he did have today.
Jane,
can you hear me?
Sorry, I missed you at the start there. I had the wrong fader up. Davy Russell, tell us, how did he get on?
You missed me at the start, Marie. It's been a long day, but we'll get there. We're nearly at 7 o'clock.
Alan Crowley's here as well.
Yes, I was listening to Alan. Poor old Dundalk will have to pull up their socks, but after that analysis, they'll have no choice.
You're dead right, Jane. You're dead right. They'll have to pull up their socks.
Good to know someone's listening.
God loves honesty, and results always speak anyway, so we may as well be straight. Davey's back, and I think the fact that he came back with two rides, one in a maiden hurdle and one in a beginner's chase, both at Downpatrick today, proves his hunger, because he could have easily just come back and ridden in nice races at Listowel next week, but he's getting his eye in. He wasn't on the winner's board, but he was second in the beginner's chase, and he's a ride in Navan tomorrow, all of course building to the Listowel Harvest Festival next week, where I'm sure he'll have an array of nice rides for Gordon Elliott, who was on the winners board today. But yeah, great to see him back. A lot of people didn't think it was likely, but I did listen to him on the show earlier in the week, and it seems like he was never in doubt.
42, fair play to him. Like, geez, he's some dedication to get back.
Jane, can I ask you just how good, I know obviously the focus on Davy, but the young lad, Jordan Gainford, who obviously got a winner for Gordon in that race that Davy finished second, just how good is that young lad?
Yeah, he's a natural. He's got a gift. I hope he's not listening because it might go to his head. But no, he. Do you know what? Jack Kennedy came back today as well as Davey. Jack has had an unbelievable hard luck run of injuries, and Jack has a gift as well. They just seem almost to a normal onlooker. They look like birds on a horse. They look like they're no weight, as if they're just floating there, and they're very natural. They don't impede a horse's rhythm at all. And I suppose maybe those young guys watching Davy and Ruby and Paul Carby down through the years, that's what those guys were like. And I think all the practice in the world, all the gymming in the world, you can be a master tactician, but you just have to have that natural finesse. And I think that you can't disguise that. You either have it or you don't.
Very wise words there from you, Jane Mangan. Okay, we don't have a lot of time, so you're going to have to give us a tip for the weekend before we sign off.
We'll rattle through it, right? So Irish Champions Weekend is gone, so that means we're basically onto the National Hunt scene, which is obviously Kerry National Week next week. I do like Easy Game. It's a 3-runner race on Sunday at Listowel in the Kerry Group Chase. The Storyteller Easy Game and Ballyoshin Easy Game just beaten in the Galway Plate. And then there is one flat race that is of significant interest, Cross Channel at Belmont, where Bolshoi Ballet runs in the Jockey Club Gold Cup at in New York. But for me, Easy Game, and it marks the start of the National Hunt. Welcome to Listowel, everybody. I hope whoever's going will enjoy it.
Jane Mangan, as always, thank you so much for joining us. Alan Cawley, thank you as well for coming in. Very much appreciated. We will be back on Monday. Ruby will be with us on Tuesday to go through everything at Listowel. But for everybody else, enjoy the weekend.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Healthy dinners made easy with Green Farm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillets range. Available in selected stores nationwide. 2